This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
Hello, Dominic.
Hi, Katie.
Hello, both of you.
Whoa, who is this?
It's an intruder.
Kick him out.
No, stay.
I mean, well, you're here now, so you may as well stay.
You're very welcome. As you will have deduced, listeners, it's not just me and Katie this week. We are being joined by producer Andre Popovicu, who worked with us a lot earlier in the year. Welcome, Andre. And actually, the reason why we've asked you to join us today is because of the work you've been doing when you've not been here.
Yeah, so a lot of my work focuses on migration and human rights in Europe. And I've written about things like the high-tech equipment that gets used on Europe's borders to stop asylum seekers from getting in. But also, I've been working with a journalism nonprofit called Lighthouse Reports. And they've been doing a lot of work for the past years on pushbacks.
And what are pushbacks?
Well, let me tell you about one that was caught on camera by the Turkish Coast Guard. There's not much audio to play you, but I can describe the scene. It's the 8th of June, 2020, around 6 in the morning. We are in the Aegean Sea between Greece and Turkey, close to the Greek island of Lesbos. And there's a boat in the water, a rubber dinghy. It's very overcrowded, and there's about a dozen people on board. All of these people have made a long journey from war-torn countries. And each of them has paid a smuggler thousands of euros to come from Turkey to Greece, where the EU begins. As they enter Greek waters, a big, imposing ship approaches, casting a huge shadow over the dinghy. This ship is run by the Romanian Coast Guard. You can see the flag on the side.
And what is a Romanian ship doing so far from home?
It's there on behalf of Frontex, an organization you might have heard of. Frontex is the EU's border agency. Its job is to manage the outside borders of the EU. So, the Frontex ship approaches this rubber dinghy full of asylum seekers. It's in the front of the dinghy, and it appears to block it. We're within EU waters, and in theory, if these people want to claim asylum, they should be able to do that. But they can't get to land because the ship is in the way. A little while later, the Greek Coast Guard arrive, and the Frontex ship moves away. The Greek Coast Guard sends a motorboat out to approach the asylum seekers, and this motorboat makes a big swooping motion directly in front of their little dinghy at high speed. The boats are close, they could easily crash, and even if they don't crash, this motion by the Greek boat is churning the water, and this fragile dinghy looks like it might capsize. The passengers could drown.
And why would the Greek Coast Guard do this weird maneuver?
Well, they're trying to push the asylum seekers away, back into Turkish waters, so that they don't enter the EU. And this is what we call the pushback.
I mean, that must have been incredibly scary for the people in the dinghy. I can't even imagine. And also, just like, what a welcome to Europe, you know?
And just to be clear, if you make it to the EU and you're seeking asylum, seeking protection because it's unsafe to go home, you have the right to do that under international law. And pushing people back is totally illegal.
And it seems like both the EU ship, which blocked the dinghy, and the Greek one that made all these dangerous waves, both of them were trying to make that a hell of a lot more difficult for the migrants in this dinghy, or even impossible.
Yeah, completely. And thing is, these scenes are widespread. Over the past years, I've been a part of this team of journalists from around Europe who've been documenting cases of asylum seekers being pushed back like this, at the edges of the EU. And when it happens on land, it's sometimes men in balaclavas, beating the asylum seekers to push them back over the border. There are many testimonies documenting this, across the Balkans and in the Aegean Sea.
And the fact that the men doing this are often masked, I'm assuming that's to make it harder to identify them, given that they're in fact doing something illegal. Do we know who the men are who take part in these operations? Are they just like thugs acting on their own initiative, or are these actually people working for European governments?
Well, governments have denied their involvement in pushbacks. After all, it's illegal. But in this investigation for Lighthouse Reports, we used a bunch of different forensic techniques to try to identify these men. And in some cases, we managed to prove that these men do indeed work for national governments. We did that by identifying things like the insignia on their jackets or the equipment they were using.
It goes without saying that it is shocking that this is happening on our borders, regardless of who is doing it. It should not be happening. We thoroughly recommend that you check out the reporting that Lighthouse Reports have done on this. But this week, we wanted to turn our attention to the role of Frontex in all of this. And in particular, we wanted to understand how we got here to a situation that looks an awful lot like an EU agency participating in a pushback. Is Frontex really fit for purpose?
Maybe it would be good if we understood a bit more about how Frontex got created in the first place.
Okay, to do that, we need to go back a few decades to understand the conditions that made the creation of Frontex possible. So in 1985, five countries, Belgium, France, West Germany, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands, they sat down in this tiny little town called Schengen.
The agreement abolishing border controls was negotiated in the Luxembourg town of Schengen. That's why it's called the Schengen Accord.
Schengen!
We know Schengen.
And that's the place where European countries decided that they weren't going to have internal border checks anymore.
The voice you're hearing is Jorrit Rijpman.
I'm a professor of European Union law at the University of Leiden, and I've been studying Frontex and migration law for quite a bit.
The fact that these five countries decided to get rid of checks on the borders between them, well, that was pretty major. Suddenly, if you're a Belgian citizen, you could go to France or Germany without anyone checking your passport. But as a Serbian, for example, you'd still need a visa to get into this new Schengen zone, and there'd have to be a border guard to check it. Basically, if you open the internal borders,
you're gonna have a problem because you can no longer check who comes into your territory, so you have to shift those controls to the external borders.
Right, so if the borders within are open, policing the external borders becomes, like, more important.
Exactly. You can think of the Schengen area as a labyrinth. They're chopping down the hedges inside the labyrinth, but at the same time, they're growing the outside walls of the labyrinth, making them taller and thicker. What this means in practice is that these countries suddenly have to work out a bunch of common rules about how we treat these borders around the edges. Who do we let in? Who do we not let in?
We're simply going to shift the controls to the external borders, just like we are going to agree on rules on who is responsible for an asylum request. Or we need to have a common visa policy.
And as they're trying to work out these shared rules on border stuff, Schengen is growing. By 1999, there are 10 countries within this borderless area. Countries like Austria, Spain, and Portugal join as well. And there's so much overlap between the countries in Schengen and the countries in the EU, and I'm oversimplifying this, but the Eurocrats eventually decide to just merge the two things. So the EU basically absorbs Schengen and it becomes part of EU law. And it's really at this point that we start seeing the EU's border policies becoming one homogenous thing.
So is that how we get Frontex then?
We're not quite there yet. At first, the EU decides to just let national border guards work out how to manage all this stuff. Here's Jorrit again.
But very soon they realized it's better if you take that away a bit from politics. If you let national border guards authorities work together with each other, a little bit like, you know, professionals, technical specialists, let them work together. They know what's best from a very operational perspective.
But they do need someone to coordinate all these national border guards. So, in 2004, comes the birth of... Deep breath. The European Agency for the Management of Operational Cooperation at the External Borders of the Member States of the European Union.
Oh, well done. You said the whole thing. How do the receptionists answer the phone for this organization? Are they like, hello, the European Agency for the... what is it? I've already forgotten what it is.
Well, that's why everyone quickly started referring to the agency as Frontex.
Frontex is definitely shorter. It does kind of sound like a brand of Tupperware or...
Yeah, it does.
Or some kind of high-tech rain jacket you'd get at Uniqlo.
Yeah, I think it's more Decathlon than Uniqlo. Anyways, let's get back on track.
Frontex is often called the European Border Guard, but especially in the beginning, its task was to help national border guards guard their part of the external border, and especially when they were working together. So they would coordinate, they would facilitate, they would help the exchange of information.
Throughout the early 2000s, Frontex is developing into this agency, an agency that helps member states on the edges of the EU manage their external borders. But it isn't really in the public eye. That all changes in 2015. Thousands
of migrants have streamed into Europe.
Europe's migrant crisis is getting worse by the day.
A migrant crisis spiraling out of control.
Hundreds of thousands of asylum seekers are...
2015 was probably the craziest year of my life as a journalist. I was reporting from Lesbos, that Greek island near where The Pushback was filmed. And we would drive to the beach and sit there and watch all of these boats coming in on the horizon from Turkey. Like little rubber dinghies, exactly like the one that we heard about at the beginning of the podcast. And when the boats made it to the beach, people would be like kissing the sand and crying. They were so relieved to have made it to the EU. It's an incredibly emotional thing to watch. A lot of these people were Syrians who just fled the war. There are also lots of Iraqis and Afghans.
And how did the authorities deal with it at the time?
Well, the Greek authorities were just completely overwhelmed by the situation. They did not know what to do. And also, it was pretty clear that basically none of these people wanted to stay in Greece. It was a kind of transit country. Pretty much everyone I interviewed said, oh yeah, we're trying to go to Germany. So while I was there, at least, the police would just let people get on ferries to mainland Greece and start traveling up from Southeast Europe towards Western Europe.
Right, so suddenly the fact that we have no internal borders within most of the EU, that means there is suddenly this incredible, intense attention on our external borders. But there's an important aspect here. Under EU asylum law, there's this thing called the Dublin Regulation. And that says that once an asylum seeker is registered in the country, they should do their whole asylum application there. Most people want to go to Germany because Angela Merkel had come out and said, refugees are welcome here.
Wir haben so vieles geschafft, wir schaffen das. Wir schaffen das, und wo uns etwas im Wege steht, muss es überwunden werden.
Right, it was this famously bold political decision that Merkel took.
But to get there, they all have to travel through Europe, which means they have to avoid being registered in the country where they arrived, usually Greece or Italy. And that often means people are making these nerve-wracking journeys through the EU, trying not to get stopped by the authorities. Because if they get stopped, they might not be able to carry on to Germany or wherever they're headed.
So this whole dream of borderless life within Schengen clearly doesn't apply to everyone.
Yeah, and where exactly is Frontex in all of this back in 2015? Is it trying to enforce this policy of people having to apply for asylum in the countries where they arrived?
No, not really. Frontex is mostly just people sitting in an office in Warsaw, coordinating national border guards and sharing information between countries. That and search and rescue operations in the Mediterranean. And it's already getting some criticism of how it's handling those, but nothing like the criticism it's going to get later on.
Also, it feels like back in 2015, the political mood was pretty different. It's not like populism didn't exist, obviously, but for a little while, I seem to remember there being some sort of openness to people fleeing war and ISIS and other terrible situations.
Yeah, and it takes a couple of years before we start seeing the amount of pushbacks at the borders we see now. But it's fair to say that after 2015, the EU started thinking, okay, maybe we need to take another look at what Frontex does.
And then, of course, the refugee crisis, a fundamental reform of Frontex. It was even rebaptized. It was called now the European Border and Coast Guard Agency. And actually, there for the first time, legislation says this really is a joint responsibility.
Okay, so they changed the ridiculously long name, but it's still Frontex for short.
Yes, but this wave of arrivals, it also changed the nature of the agency. In response to this so-called migrant crisis, Frontex started getting more responsibilities and more power.
Frontex is Europe's border and coast guard agency, helping to manage migration flows and respond to cross-border crime. At land borders, sea borders, and at airports.
So for one thing, the EU starts pouring tons of money into it. Back in 2005, Frontex has a budget of a little over 6 million. By the end of this year, it's expected to reach 543 million.
What? That's insane.
How does that compare to other EU agencies?
Well, the short answer is that Frontex is the best funded agency in the EU. There's one other big thing that changes after this quote-unquote migrant crisis. In 2019, Frontex finally get their own officers.
Okay, so they've got their own kind of boots on the ground. Who are these people? Like, where do they come from?
Frontex just recently created what they call the Standing Corps.
With the Standing Corps, Europe's first uniformed service, Frontex is where European countries need us most, working together with them for a safer, more secure Europe.
They're basically border police officers hired from all EU member states. Right now, there's about 5,000 of them working for Frontex, and they're deployed throughout Europe, wherever they're needed. Do you remember the whole fuss about Emmanuel Macron wanting the EU to have an army and all that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is the closest the EU has got to that. But it's not an EU army because...
the EU is not a state. So you can't have EU border guards under like EU control. So what they did is they sort of created EU border guards, but they will always operate under the control and command of a national border guards authority. They're like nationless, flagless border guards who take on the flag of the country where they're needed.
They're aiming to have up to 10,000 of these officers by 2027. They also can get deployed to countries that aren't actually in the EU, but just across the border. So like Serbia, Albania, North Macedonia.
But what is the consequence of it? The consequence of it is, I think, that the external border is increasingly seen as a common responsibility. And I think that makes sense. If you have no internal border controls, then you're jointly responsible for what's happening at the external borders, for good and for bad.
Okay, so after 2015, Europe is absorbing these huge numbers of arrivals. Frontex gets beefed up and it becomes a bigger deal. But let's get back to that boat that we heard being pushed back into Turkish waters at the beginning of this podcast, because that was illegal. And I want to know what Frontex was doing there.
How do we know for sure that this incident was, in fact, an illegal pushback, actually?
Well, in 2019, a bunch of journalists gathered in Amsterdam, and they were a part of this investigative journalism outlet called Lighthouse Reports.
Which is where you've been working a lot this year, right?
Yes, but I didn't work with them on this specific investigation. Anyways, they'd noticed this super rapid growth in Frontex's responsibilities and that enormous budget, and they decided to take a closer look.
We talked to people who understood the institution about whether or not its own internal policing infrastructure was up to the job.
That is Daniel Howden from Lighthouse Reports, speaking at an online event about how they started investigating Frontex.
And they said, no, it's not. Well, what about their procurement? Is the way that they set about doing tenders and contracts, is that up to standard? And the answer was no. Well, what are they doing operationally? Well, it's really hard to know because they restrict the amount of information that's available. They won't answer simple questions about what resources they deploy and where they go.
So these journalists were thinking, Frontex feels like something that definitely needs looking into. It's now 2019 and the whole mood has shifted. Countries are increasingly saying no. No more people coming in, we can't handle it, we don't want to resettle all these people.
AfD is targeting discontented voters, especially those disappointed with Merkel's policy on refugees. Press finds her motto, "We can do this," abhorrent.
European countries start trying to make the environment more hostile, to deter people from even trying to come. Many asylum seekers get stuck living in really horrible conditions in camps on Lesbos.
Like the Moria camp that burned down last year.
Yeah, exactly. That's a perfect example. And around 2017, you start getting more reports of people being pushed back at land borders in the Balkans and by the Greek Coast Guard in the Aegean Sea, illegally. And there are a lot of these reports. They're coming from asylum seekers themselves, the NGOs who work with them, and journalists. But governments like Greece and Croatia are denying that they have anything to do with this. Sometimes these incidents are caught on camera. And the journalists at Lighthouse Reports were thinking, well, Frontex has all these boats in the Aegean and all these drones surveilling the area. Surely they must know about the illegal pushbacks.
It was clear to us that in the Aegean, there were obvious violations of international law happening. Frontex was present They had surveillance equipment that was there that was highly sophisticated. It was very hard to believe that they couldn't be, at the very least, knowledgeable about what was going on.
At this stage, though, no one had actually proved that Frontex themselves had been present during a pushback. So the journalists start looking for evidence. They start mapping where Frontex is, things like the location of its boats and its planes. And they're trying to prove whether any of those were there while pushbacks were happening. The journalists used things like online tools that track vessels. And it wasn't easy. Some Frontex vessels turned their transponders off, so you can't track them. But some Frontex boats didn't do that. You could check where they were geographically and when.
Aha, clever.
After that, the journalists found the videos by the Turkish Coast Guard of that scene you heard at the top of this episode.
Greek Coast Guard, this is Turkish Coast Guard. You are now pushing back the migrants to Turkish territorial waters. This action is violation of international law. You are executing...
We can compare the landscape of Google Earth versus the landscape that you can see in one of these videos. It matches pretty much perfectly with the landscape that you can see from that location on Google Earth. So we've got the location, we're confident about that.
This is Nick Waters. He works for Bellingcat. They're another investigative outlet. Nick worked with Lighthouse on this investigation, and he and his colleagues proved that this video was filmed on the 8th of June, 2020, in that exact same spot in the Aegean, inside EU territory. In the video, you can see the Romanian boat with MAI 1103 written on the side. That's a Frontex boat.
We took those kind of open sources, the ship tracking data, the AIS data, data from more traditional journalistic techniques, such as the information about where these pushbacks were reported to have taken place, the videos that were received from Turkish Coast Guard to establish what happened on the 8th of June.
So they have it. A smoking gun. Proof that Frontex officers were present at a breach of international law. A pushback. Inside EU territory. This is one of the 13 instances in which the journalists found Frontex planes or boats in the vicinity of a pushback. Though, in this situation, it seems that the Frontex vessel, which appears to have been blocking the dinghy, may have been complicit in the pushback.
Okay, hang on. What does complicit mean? Do we know whether Frontex has actually broken the law?
No major EU body has come out and formally said Frontex has broken international law. In this case, or in any other case. There's a lot of conversations happening in various NGO watchdogs and within the EU itself. And everyone's expressing concerns and suspicions that Frontex has broken the law. But the jury is out, for now.
Either way, this strikes me as one of those situations that really shows why investigative journalists are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
We just wouldn't have a lot of this evidence if it wasn't for these journalists painstakingly piecing it all together.
Yeah, completely.
But it does leave me with a lot more questions. So who signed off in the pushback? Was it the Greek Coast Guard, Frontex itself? Was this just some rogue officers doing something extremely shady? Or is it more like an official policy, even if it's illegal?
Yeah, exactly. We don't know, really. It's incredibly hard to pinpoint these things. But what we do know is that Frontex has a huge command center with a live video feed from their vessels and drones in the area. They see everything in the Mediterranean, and they've been close by when pushbacks have happened.
And what did Frontex have to say when the journalists put all of this evidence forward about pushbacks where they've been present, or at least nearby?
Well, they formed this group inside Frontex to investigate, to see if there was any wrongdoing. And in the group's report, Frontex acknowledged, and I'm just going to get the quote, they have the strong belief that the presented facts support an allegation of possible violation of fundamental rights or international protection obligations.
Okay, it's a bit of a mouthful. But reading between the lines, they're saying maybe a pushback happened?
Yeah, it sounds like a fancy way of saying, we don't know for sure.
We've been mostly talking about Frontex off the coast of Greece and in the Balkans. But there's also the situation around asylum seekers trying to reach Europe from Libya. And we know from the Lighthouse journalists in the same investigation that Frontex vessels have spotted rubber dinghies in the Mediterranean and told the Libyan Coast Guard where they were, so they could come pick these migrants up and take them back to Libya.
And Libyan migrant detention centres are some of the worst places on earth. There have been so many reports of abuse and rape and degrading treatment in these places.
Yeah, and the EU knows this as well, but they still fund Libyan Coast Guard. And it seems that Frontex collaborates with them actively to prevent people from reaching Europe's shores.
This whole thing makes me feel incredibly ashamed. You know, I want to be part of a Europe that protects people. I do not want to be part of a Europe that is so determined not to take in asylum seekers that it is willing to send them back to these horrific detention centers.
Yeah, and it's especially upsetting when you think about the fact that the whole reasons pushbacks are illegal is because of our history, because of the terrible things that happened in Europe in the 20th century to people who were just looking for safety.
In the run-up to the Second World War and during, is that people would arrive at the border. Jewish refugees would arrive at the Swiss border or the Dutch border, or would be the SS St. Louis, the boat that was going to the US and was refused in every port. And from that, we sort of learned that, you know, you don't send people back. You may not give them asylum, but you should give them the chance to ask for it. And you need to make sure that, you know, you don't send them back to a place where their life is in danger.
Jorrit also made another really interesting point. In theory, Frontex could be the perfect agency to actually report pushbacks, to make sure that border guards are following their legal obligations. They could be the people who stop these kinds of abuses from happening.
Now, again, remember, Frontex is not in command and control, but it does have an obligation, for instance, to withdraw its support, to stop a joint operation. It cannot tell the Greek border guards or the Romanian border guards, for this matter, what to do. It can say, if your guys are doing this, we're out. No more money, we're not participating in this. And this is the big critique on Frontex, that it has actually condoned this.
Right, there's a universe where Frontex could be the solution to preventing illegal pushbacks. But that doesn't seem to be what's happening.
The allegations and the reports have been that there have been pushbacks, particularly in Greek waters, where Frontex was very much aware that this was happening.
And so, where is the rest of the EU in all this? Are they just kind of fine with everything that Frontex has been doing?
Well, no. And that's why we should probably be grateful that the EU has a parliament, and that parliament answers to us as citizens and holds other parts of the EU to account. So the European Parliament had been planning to look into Frontex's activity for a while. And this was mainly because of this huge increase in its budget. But the investigation by the journalists made the MEPs think, okay, it's really urgent that we look into this. So they formed what's called a scrutiny group to investigate these allegations about Frontex and the pushbacks.
So, good morning, everyone, on this Friday, sunny day in Brussels. Thank you for being here as we start off with this meeting of the Libre Working Group on Frontex Scrutiny.
And so, what is the job of this scrutiny group exactly?
Well, I called one of its members to explain. Tineke Strik. She's a Dutch MEP from the Green Party.
It's a gathering of MEPs from different political groups which monitors how Frontex is exactly functioning in practice. So how it's implementing the obligations of EU law, because there are several regulations for Frontex specifically. And in those regulations, it's also provided that Frontex is accountable to the European Parliament. So we are the one who have the task to make sure there's a democratic accountability for Frontex.
And the way that these scrutiny groups work is that if it's signaled that something is wrong, the MEPs have all these hearings to get to the bottom of what's happened. So in this case, they had 4 months of hearings with Frontex officials themselves, but also legal scholars, NGOs, and the journalists who've been investigating them. Here's Tineke again.
What we found was that Frontex was indeed aware of pushbacks taking place. We have even seen a video made by Frontex of a pushback taking place in the middle of the night, where the Greek Coast Guard sailed towards a rubber dinghy with migrants, took the migrants on board, and then brought them to a place very close to the Turkish border, put the migrants again in the rubber dinghy, stripped the motor of the dinghy and sailed away. So they were really leaving those people behind, putting them in a very dangerous situation. And Frontex saw it from its own airplane, saw it happening.
I really just don't understand how it's even possible that this is happening. It's such a grim situation, and It sounds like really damning evidence. I mean, at least the scrutiny group seemed to really be getting to the bottom of things.
And I'm guessing the boss of Frontex had to testify during these hearings, right?
Right, yeah.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, honorable members of the parliament.
His name is Fabrice Leggeri. He's a French guy in his 50s, and he took over Frontex in 2015, right about the time when all of the asylum seekers were arriving.
And what did he tell all the MEPs when they confronted him about the pushbacks?
Well, he said there was no evidence that Frontex staff had done anything illegal.
There were different inquiries. They have taken place or are ongoing. And at this point of time, there is no proof of the participation of Frontex in maritime pushbacks.
So even in cases where there's evidence that Frontex has been nearby, their boss is saying there's no evidence that we actually participated in the pushback. Is that what he's saying?
Possibly. But he's also tried to downplay the evidence documenting the pushbacks, saying things like, okay, there are some videos, but Frontex itself cannot confirm they're legit.
It was not possible to carry out a forensic analysis, so we cannot authenticate the date, the location of what can be seen on all these videos.
His attitude has been to really refuse to accept that there's any wrongdoing by his staff. But the MEPs investigating Frontex, in their final report, they actually said that they had evidence that Leggeri had personally destroyed proof of a pushback.
Jesus.
And I think everyone is fed up with him denying everything despite the evidence. Here's an MEP questioning him during a hearing.
Mr. Leggeri, I listened carefully each time and so did I today. But even if you don't stop repeating that there is no proof, there's enough evidence by UNHCR, NGOs and journalists. Do you believe that after all these incriminating results of the investigations, you are in a position to continue to be at the head of this agency?
So there's been a lot of pressure on Leggeri to resign, not just for this refusal to accept any blame over pushbacks, but also over accusations that he has systematically undermined Frontex's own ability to keep a check on its bad behavior. I'll give you an example. A couple of years ago, Frontex was ordered by the European Parliament to hire 40 officers to investigate allegations of human rights abuses from inside Frontex itself. But there have been huge delays to this under Leggeri. They only started to hire people this summer, and they've still only hired half of the people they were supposed to.
I'm curious, have you actually managed to speak to anyone from Frontex?
Well, I've been trying pretty hard to do that. Initially, their spokesperson did agree to an interview. But then I got a phone call from him saying he saw my reporting and I don't seem to have Frontex's best interest in mind.
Frontex's best interest. It's such an ironic phrase. As if they're the people that you should be worrying about the most.
Yeah, and he said he'd think about it and get back to me. But a week passed and I called him back. No answer. A couple of days later, I call him again. No answer. I started emailing him. Nothing. After about 6 unanswered emails, I finally got a response. Dear Andre, thank you for contacting Frontex. We regret to inform you that we won't be able to take part in this podcast.
Surprise, surprise.
But I didn't give up so easily. I messaged Frontex's fundamental rights officer on LinkedIn. And with a bit of convincing, he agreed to a 15-minute phone call. His name is Jonas Grimhidden.
Hello, Andre.
Hi, Jonas. Can you hear me? Thanks so much for taking
the
time.
His job is to independently check whether the agency is respecting fundamental rights during its operations.
Those 40 officers I mentioned before, they would be under his command.
That sounds like a pretty key job.
It is. And I asked him about whether it's been easy or not to investigate Frontex's behavior from the inside and make sure there's no wrongdoing.
I think I'm fortunate to come to the agency at a good moment. The regulation that regulates the work of the agency is new. The post that I have is reinforced. It's new. And importantly, in that context, my independence is reinforced.
You know, there's been a lot of evidence about pushbacks before you took on this role, about Frontex's awareness or presence during pushbacks and sometimes even an alleged complicity. What would you say about those allegations? Do you believe them to be credible?
It's very difficult to say, was there enough evidence? Is there enough evidence? Will there ever be enough evidence? I think to some extent, it's impossible to prove some of the things that are alleged for very operational reasons. They happen in a difficult context. There are stories on both sides that seem plausible. So I'm not a court of law that simply decides you're right, you're wrong. That might be an easier task at times.
How do you think you will change the way fundamental rights are respected during Frontex operations, the way they're reported, and, you know, this whole dimension of Frontex?
When I'm leaving this job, whenever I do, I would like there to be fundamental rights at the core of the organization, not a fringe topic that is in conflict with security or other concerns, but something that is essential for the agency to work properly. If we compromise fundamental rights or human rights international obligations for the European Union or for the member states, there's a risk that we compromise the raison d'etre of the European Union, of the Schengen agreement, of the EU as a whole.
It was really good to hear from Jonas, but I really wasn't surprised that Frontex officials were otherwise not keen to talk to us for this podcast. They have quite a reputation for being untransparent.
How do you mean?
There have been a few cases of activists requesting information from Frontex, and they didn't get it. So they went to court for it. They lost, and then get this. Frontex asked the activists to pay its trial costs, which amounts to tens of thousands of euros.
Whoa, that's a huge amount of money to pay, especially when these activists were just requesting information.
And especially if you think about that huge budget that Frontex has, it's just scandalous.
Yeah, and one of the groups who got hit by these Frontex legal fees was this German transparency NGO called Fragenstadt. And to shame Frontex for doing this to people who just wanted information, they brought a suitcase containing 10,520 euros and 76 cents in cash to Frontex's offices. That's how much they were supposed to pay.
I mean, how Frontex possibly thought that trying to bankrupt transparency activists is a good look? It's just beyond me.
It seems to me like there are various things at Frontex that have been really not well managed under its current boss. But it does feel like something more systemic has gone wrong at this agency, right? You can't just blame one person for all of this.
Yeah, and Jorrit also made exactly that point.
No, I don't think you can blame that on one man. You can blame that also on the member states, on a European migration and asylum policy, on the perhaps unreasonable demands that are put on an agency that is being overstaffed and overfunded. Basically, it's also... Frontex is very much a proxy of a failing migration and asylum policy. We cannot agree on solidarity. We don't manage to agree on actually taking care of asylum and migration together. So what do we do instead? We throw a lot of money at an agency and say, keep the borders closed. That's not really a solution. So that things then go wrong doesn't surprise me.
Lots of people critical of Frontex have accused its boss of prioritizing strict borders, not letting people in, over respecting people's basic human rights to claim asylum here. But the thing is, the jury is answerable partly to the EU's national government. And it's not like these governments want looser borders.
Right, so on a national level, a lot of member states are pretty invested in stopping migration towards Europe, and Frontex is fulfilling that wish.
And when you think about the politicians in those governments, what they do is shaped by trying to get re-elected. And let's face it, looking tough on asylum seekers has been a depressingly popular policy among quite a lot of voters in recent years.
Yeah, and here's the thing. Not much is going to change if some countries refuse to take on a share of the responsibility for accepting asylum seekers, integrating them, and returning them if their application is denied. Because as the law is now, asylum seekers need to ask for asylum in the first country they arrive.
That's this Dublin procedure thing that we talked about earlier, right?
Yeah, exactly. And Ursula von der Leyen has said she wants to reform it, and we're supposed to be getting a new EU asylum agency. But because of, like, geography, southern European countries are a major point of entry to the EU. So Greece, Italy, Spain... These countries have had an incentive to strictly control the borders because they've been the ones disproportionately accommodating asylum seekers.
And I guess the northern countries don't want to call out the southern countries for pushing people back and maybe breaking international law. So the northern countries don't want to take responsibility for the asylum claims either.
Yeah, and there have been some attempts to relocate asylum seekers across the EU over the past few years, but they've largely failed because quite a few countries, like Poland, Denmark, Hungary, the Czech Republic, for example, they've refused to take people in. So things are currently in a stalemate.
Well, you've really taken us on a wild ride, Andre, a pretty disturbing one. What's happening with Frontex now?
Well, Tinnike's scrutiny group has made recommendations for changes to how Frontex makes sure that fundamental rights are respected during operations. So far, Leggeri said that out of 42 recommendations, 40 have been implemented or are in the course of being implemented. But in the meantime, Tinnike has been pushing for the rest of the EU, like the Commission, basically the government of the EU, to do more to stop the pushbacks.
The silence from the Commission as guardian of the treaties and from the member states have encouraged border countries to make these pushbacks a systematic practice. Dear Commissioner, I know that you condemn pushbacks, but you are the vital actor who is able to put those words into practice. We depend on you to stop these flagrant violations and ensure protection, to start infringement procedures, make funding conditional, and to ensure that Frontex does not facilitate but prevent pushbacks.
There have also been a bunch of different investigations into Frontex and court cases going on. More than 10 over the past year. And these are cases at the European Court of Justice, the EU Anti-Fraud Agency, and many other places.
But so far, no EU body has formally come out and charged Frontex with breaking international law, right?
Yeah, and it doesn't seem likely right now that they will do that. But even if they don't, the European Parliament has the power to withdraw some of Frontex's budget if there's been wrongdoing. And they actually did that recently. They froze 90 million euros from Frontex's 2022 budget and said, if you want this money, you need to get much better at investigating human rights abuses internally.
Well, I guess it's good that there's been some kind of financial consequences after everything that's happened. But as we talked about on the show last week, there's now this increasingly worrying situation on the border between Poland and Belarus. Asylum seekers are being weaponized by Belarus as part of a political game, and Poland wants to legalize pushbacks as a response to that. And in the meantime, people are literally freezing to death on the external border of the European Union.
Warsaw accuses strongman Alexander Lukashenko of punishing Europe for the sanctions it imposed on the authoritarian regime this summer. Minsk is believed to be ferrying people from the Middle East and Africa to the Belarusian border to pressure the bloc.
This has not been an easy conversation. I think it goes without saying that, you know, we love Europe on this podcast. That is why we make this podcast. But that doesn't mean that we believe in pretending that the EU is this perfect institution. And when there's terrible wrongdoing like this, and it hurts people who are looking for safety, we need to talk about it. And I'm really glad that we did that this week.
How do you feel about all of this, Andre, after reporting this story?
I think the main thing is that we as a continent need to take a good long look at whether we are really invested in these core values we talk about. Peace, basic human rights, dignity. We talk about these European values, and these should be applied to everyone, right? We need to think long and hard about whether we're actually doing that.
This podcast was reported by Andre Popoviciu and produced by Andre and Katz Laszlo, with editorial support from Katz Laszlo, Katie Lee, Wojciech Oleksiak, and me, Dominic Kramer. Sound design was by Andre Popoviciu and Wojciech Oleksiak. Wojciech also mixed this episode, and Katie Lee was our editor. Music came from Blue Dot Sessions, Artlist.io, and Jim Barn. Sound effects came from freesound.org. Some of the tape you heard in this episode is from European Parliament debates and a Lighthouse Reports public webinar. This episode is a part of Sphera, a collective of independent media from across Europe. We also want to thank our Patreon supporters for making it possible for us to produce this episode. This podcast is part of the Are We Europe family. Find more like-minded European podcasts at areweeurope.com/audio-family. Thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next week.